Through the tunnel.
Okay, if we can get started.
Morning, we're going to hear this.
Just want to make sure the tape is running.
They were very pretty, though.
Okay, today's hearing is primarily informational. We have a bill of Senator Metzen's at the end of the committee. But as we always do, we'd like to begin this session's mini hearings listening to Dr. Stinson and Mr. Showalter in discussion of the budget forecast. I think some of you were at the forecast briefing in December. I'm not sure. Looking around the table, I'm not sure how many people were there. But obviously always instructive to listen to both of them. So, Mr. Showalter, I know Dr. Stinson was – oh, sorry. So welcome again to the committee with this year a fairly bleak prognosis, I would expect.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director.
I'm Tom Stinson, State Economist. We're going to talk from the handout that's entitled Minnesota Budget Forecast November 2008 Updated. And this is really a review of the November forecast, and then it updates to include the information that's in the economic update that came out last Monday. As I was walking by Senator Pariseau, I said, you know, the Cliff's Notes version of this is things are bad, they're getting worse, goodbye. And so we could stop there. I can give you just a little bit more information than that. Everybody here knows kind of the bottom line. We forecast a budget deficit of $426 million. For 2009. Revenues were down $412 million from the end of session estimates. What was interesting about that was that it was all prospective, that the revenues for fiscal year 2008 were positive, and the revenues for the first quarter of 2009 had a positive variance as well. Despite that cushion that we had because the economy had performed a little bit better than we thought, we still took $412 million in revenues out of the biennium. The outlook then for fiscal year 2010-2011, projected budget shortfall grew from $946 million to about $4.8 billion. Revenues were down $3.3 billion from end of session estimates. Expenditures up $580 million. The reason for all of this is really just an extraordinarily worse economy than was expected. We had expected a recession at the start of 2008. That recession was actually called, I think, shortly after we released the forecast in November, but the pattern has been quite different in there. If you look on the top of page 2, you can see what the pattern is that we have there. Understand this fully. What you have to have in the back of your mind is that normally the economy grows at about a 3% annual rate. And so you can see, looking back through 1998, sometimes it grows faster than a 3% rate. Sometimes it doesn't grow at a 3% rate. Occasionally it actually shrinks. See the bars that drop down in 2001. That's the 2001 recession. You can see then also what's happening in this recession, that we had a down quarter, then two quarters that were actually positive, but then the third quarter, at the time the forecast was done, was expected or was shown to have shrunk by 0.6%. The fourth quarter was expected to decline at a 3.3% annual rate. The first quarter was expected to decline at a 1.8% annual rate, and the second quarter at a 0.6% annual rate. And again, the important thing here, the distinction here, is it's not that the economy is growing more slowly. It's that the actual amount of goods and services that are produced, the physical output in the economy, is shrinking. So we are actually producing less in the way of goods and services, adjusting for prices, than we had in the past. To compare this, to give you some idea of how severe this decline is, if you look at the bottom of page 2, at the top of page 3, you can see that in the recession of 2001, the economy, even though we had a recession on a year-over-year basis, the economy fell at or grew by an 0.8% at an 0.8% rate. In 2009, in November, we were forecasting that the economy would decline by 1%. And what this really does is it delays the economic growth that we have. We're not. It doesn't mean that we're not going to grow in the future, but it does mean that we'll put off any growth that we've had. In the period up to the time that we released the forecast, the Star Tribune embedded a reporter in with the forecast group, and he wrote a story on it. And we were quoted as John Pelican, a staff economist, and I were quoted as saying, looking at a bunch of graphs and saying, this is ugly, this is really ugly, this is really, really ugly, and so on. The graph at the top of page 4 is one of the graphs that we were looking at that time. The dashed line is what was projected in February. The solid line is what we were seeing when we put the forecast up on our computer screens. And there are 40 pieces of the sales tax base, and this is what virtually all of them look like, this big gap between what we saw, what we thought was going to happen in February, which wasn't particularly optimistic, and this dramatic decline that we had there. Well, the declines that in the economy, the shrinkage in the economy means that we're going to see less jobs nationally, and it means we're going to see less jobs in Minnesota. On a quarterly basis, in Minnesota, normally we'd see about 10,000 jobs a quarter of growth. Here, over the next, over a period of about a year and a half or a year and three quarters, we're going to lose about 76,000 jobs, according to the forecast. And in this recession, we don't believe there's going to be a quick recovery. I heard a guy on television a couple days ago saying, well, he started out and he thought that this was going to be a U-shaped recovery, and then he thought it was going to be more like a soup bowl-shaped recovery. Then he thought it was going to be more like a bathtub-shaped recovery, and now he's thinking it's going to be more like a swimming pool, that we're going to have a long period where we don't have much job growth. This outlook that we have here may be a little bit optimistic, but we are going to lose a substantial number of jobs between now and the end of this recession. We're going to continue to lose jobs in construction. We're going to lose more jobs in manufacturing. We're going to lose jobs in trade. We're going to lose jobs in the services sector. This is going to be a broad loss of jobs, not just a selected area like we've had up until this fall. And then, Mr. Chairman, as you remember, when we did the leadership briefing, we had the prescience to say the recession could be worse than forecast in November, and we showed you a graph that showed the February baseline. This is at the top of page 5. We showed you a graph that had the February baseline, and then the November baseline, and then the November pessimistic scenario. And one of the things that we didn't tell you was that the November pessimistic scenario, Global Insight had given it a name, and it was called meltdown. But the difference between the baseline scenario and the pessimistic scenario in terms of the outlook for calendar year 2009, the baseline scenario had 1%, minus 1.6% growth in, or 1% growth in calendar 2009. The meltdown, which was given a 25% probability, had a 2.4% decline expected for 2009. You might want to remember that 2.4% number, that has some relevance to something I'm going to say in a minute. We also talked about our concern about capital gains. One of the things that was unusual about this forecast was that the decline in income tax revenues for fiscal 2009 came about entirely from capital gains, dividends, interest, and other portfolio income. That wages in our forecast actually were strong enough so that we did not lose withholding tax receipts. We actually gained a little bit in withholding tax receipts. The biggest item in the portfolio income in terms of the losses was expected capital gains, and there we had a decline of 30% in capital gains. Now, capital gains, as you all know, a lot of it comes from sales of financial assets, particularly equities, the gain on sales of equities. And anybody that's paid any attention to the stock market at all knows that those gains are going to be quite a bit less. We have a 30% decline forecast in capital gains for tax year 2008 and an additional 10% decline for tax year 2009. That seems like a lot, but if you look at the graph on the bottom of page 5, you see that in between 2000 and 2001, what we saw was more than a 50% decline in capital gains. Now, there are some other things that were going on at the time there that may not be. Our models are saying that we should have about a 30% decline, but states like California and New York and Massachusetts are using 50% declines in there. The Congressional Budget Office is using a 40% decline for U.S. capital gains nationally. So we could certainly be wrong. And the concern and the reason why we bring this up is even though we think we're right, we think we have the right number here, if we didn't think of this was the right number, we would be using a different number. But even though we think we're right here, we could be wrong. And if we're wrong, we won't know about it until late in the session. Early part of May is probably the first time that we'll have sufficient information to evaluate how things are going with respect to final payments and refunds for tax year 2008. What that raises is the possibility of an unpleasant surprise right at the end of session, which could be on the order of $200 million or more. And if there are no reserves, if there's no cushion in there, then your committee and the legislature and the governor are going to be faced with some very difficult challenges to meet the state's balanced budget requirement at that time with very little time and very little money left to deal with in the state's budget. We will look at this issue more when we do the February forecast, but there is so much uncertainty about the capital gains issue that you need to be aware of it, and it's one of the reasons why we're so concerned that there be a cushion, some kind of a cushion that would allow the state to avoid having to take really dramatic action right at the end of the fiscal year in case the capital gains estimate turned out to be wrong.
Mr. Chairman?
Chair Fuller.
What would be the magnitude of the need at that time?
Well, we hope it's zero, but it could be on the order of $200 to $300 million. We have had changes in capital gains. Back in 2000, and for the 2001 year, we forecast a 35% drop in capital gains, and it actually dropped 55%, and that cost us about $200 million. And so that's the order of magnitude we're talking about. The issues is very complicated and very hard to model. Here, it's not just an issue of what's happened to the stock market. It's what's happened to people's decisions to sell. If you don't sell, if you would have normally sold and made $10,000 or $20,000 a year on the stock market, and you don't sell, you just say, well, the market's bad, I'm just not going to sell anything this year. You know, that costs us revenue because even though you haven't realized those gains or any losses, you haven't realized any gain for us either. So there's this whole issue on there. Of course, losses are protected. You're only allowed a net loss of $3,000 carried forward against ordinary income. So if you had $500,000 worth of losses and you realized $500,000 of losses, we wouldn't take the full hit on the full $5,000. We'd only take the hit on the $3,000. It's more foregone activity as opposed to big losses carried forward. The concern that we have, well, we're concerned about the stock market. The piece that's really the difficult piece to have a handle on is sales of business and sales of real estate, commercial real estate. Here in recessions, the sale of businesses, which is also a capital gain, that dries up just because there's a lot less market for somebody's hardware store or drug store or whatever when times are bad than when times are good. But the credit crunch has made it virtually impossible for people to get the financing to buy a new business as well, a small business from somebody else. And so the combination of those two is likely to have made it a pretty big hit on capital gains realizations, especially during the last half of the year. You can say, why are we so optimistic compared to California and New York and to the Congressional Budget Office? And the reason why is that there's a third component of capital gains, and that's net gains that exceed $500,000 on a principal residence. And in California and along the East Coast, that was a significant part of the capital gains realizations. In Minnesota, the number of houses that were sold that had a net gain, not were priced over $500,000, but that had a net gain of over $500,000 was pretty small, and so that's not gonna tilt the estimate one way or the other. And so, because we don't have that housing component in our model, our results and the Congressional Budget Office results are pretty similar without the housing part in it. But we could be wrong.
What would, Mr. Chairman, what would be the impact on the farm or the ag cohort?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Foley, I assume what you're saying is the sales of farm real estate in there. I don't think that's not a big enough part of the capital gains base to be material in this. It really is the sale of small business and the sale of commercial real estate and the sale of stocks and financial instruments. Those are the pieces that are important.
Thank you.
Let's see, where are we at here? Yeah. Okay. Real quickly then, top of page six, the budget deficit, $426 million. Again, the revenue losses are all prospective. Sales tax is down $291 million in fiscal 2009. Income tax is down $291 million. Sales tax is down $145 million. Corporate tax is down $57 million. Other revenues, and here the primary contributor of this was insurance gross premiums, were up $80 million. But this is just a kind of a uniform decline in the outlook affecting all of the state's revenue sources. Moving on to 2010-2011, revenues are down again, the income tax down $1.8 billion, 10%. The sales tax down $826 million, 8.7%. Usually the sales tax provides us with a little bit more stable base than we have here, but sales tax receipts just have plummeted. The fact that the recession has turned into a consumer spending-driven recession affects our sales tax receipts, obviously. Corporate taxes down $640 million. Motor vehicle taxes, a small portion of the state's general fund base, but still down 9%. Other revenues down again. That's kind of the story that we were telling you in the first week of December. And when I testified before your committee, right after we did the forecast, I made mention of the fact that the Department of Finance has a three-day rule where nobody can come and tell us bad news or tell us about, oh, did you realize that you spelled the T-E-H on page 47 as opposed to T-H-E or any of those things that we want to be right for 3 days. I think we did the perfect forecast. But unfortunately, the federal government didn't observe the three-day rule in there. And what they did was they announced the day after the forecast was released that November jobs had fallen by 533,000, that we had lost 533,000 in the U.S. In November. And if that weren't bad enough, they said that, by the way, remember September we told you that we'd only lost 160,000 jobs, that actually we lost 403,000 jobs.
Oh, that's a big difference.
And, if that weren't bad enough, they also told us that we'd lost 80,000 jobs, gone from minus 240 to minus 320,000 jobs in October. this changed the perception of the economic environment pretty significantly. Mark Zandi, who's the head of Moody's Economy.com, in doing his December forecast, said that he couldn't remember a time where he had ever made such a large change between months in his forecast. And Global Insight made a large change in their forecast as well, reflecting the fact that we had lost 524,000 jobs in the month of November and 1.9 million jobs over the succeeding 4 months. That graph, to show you kind of what's gone on with respect to loss and employment, that graph's at the top of page 7. And Global Insight, as I said, has made two significant changes to their forecast since then. If you look at the bottom of page 7, you can see what how they've changed their forecast for 2009. They now have in their baseline scenario minus 2.5%, a decline of 2.5% in the economy year over year for 2009. If you remember the number that I told you to remember, the meltdown scenario baseline pessimistic scenario, that was only 2.4%. So January's Global Insight forecast is actually worse than the meltdown scenario in the short term that we were looking at in November. There's a graph at the top of page 8 that shows kind of how things have deteriorated. It's better in color. It's too busy here, but basically things have gotten worse. And in the economic update, the January economic update, there's more information about this on page 2 that you can read in there. On the first page of the economic update, though, is some more bad news, and that is that despite our best efforts on the forecast of in November, for the months of November and December, we are at a point where revenues are not meeting that forecast. Now, you remember that up until November forecast, we were not seeing negative variance or anything like that. All the revenue loss was prospective. Now, even though we've knocked the forecast down noticeably, we're still not keeping up with how weak the economy is. Income tax is down $39 million. That's pretty much all in withholding. Sales tax is down $33 million. That reflects sales in October and November because sales taxes on purchases in 1 month aren't remitted to the state until the next month, and so it won't be until the end of this month that we know how we did with respect to Christmas sales in the month of December. Corporate taxes down $57 million, 42%. That's really an overstatement of how serious the problem is, because this reflects a couple of large audits gone awry where we actually had to pay money out as opposed to collect more money in there. But
take an audit.
Corporate taxes obviously are not going to do well. Overall, $131 million or 4.5% decline. Mr. Chairman, let me close on one piece of good news, and that is that the state sold bonds last Tuesday, I think. If you remember, we had planned on selling bonds in October, but looking at the possibility of what was going on in capital markets at the time, thought that that would be just an impossible situation to do. We sold bonds for 3.5%. We had six bids for the largest portion of the bond issue. The bids were tight, the 3.50, 3.51, 3.52. They were very tight. The state of Washington had sold bonds the week before for 4.5%. They're a little bit different credit than we are, but still a decline in the interest rate of 1% was good news. Pennsylvania in December was the only other large issue since October in the competitive markets, and they sold bonds for 5%. So what this indicates is that at least in the tax-exempt market, we're beginning to see a little thawing of the credit freeze, that the credit markets are beginning to work a little bit, at least in here. And that's good news looking out for the recovery. And it's not a sufficient condition. It by itself, thawing of the tax-exempt market doesn't necessarily mean that the economy's on a turnaround, but it's an early sign that things are improving a little bit, and a counter to some of the things that the depressing news that you read in the paper, for example. The paper today talks about Bank of America needing more money to deal with its problems with Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch was actually the buyer of these bonds, and they were fully subscribed before they were purchased. And so Merrill Lynch may have a lot of toxic assets on its balance sheet, but at least they're back in the game doing things in here as well. So with that, Mr. Chairman, let me turn it back over to Jim, and he can talk about the broader budget issue here.
Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, members, on the bottom of page 9, you see a recap of where we were when we left the 2008 session. The projection for 2010 and 11 had a projected gap of $946 million due to the economic news that was incorporated into the November forecast. We saw a drop in revenues of $3.3 billion and a increase in spending of $580 million. That leads us to the $4.8 billion shortfall that we announced with that November forecast. Looking ahead on page 10, there's just a brief summary. As you can tell, most of the news of this forecast was on the revenue side. That's where you see the most direct economic hit and the most dramatic changes. However, there were some changes on the spending side, in particular in health and human services programs that are serving those who are most exposed to the changes in the economy, families and children who are in the health care services, single adults in the GAMC program. There were increased enrollment projections, and that led to about a $500 million change in health and human services. There were also some minor changes in other portions of the budget forecast, including debt service and a small increase in property tax aids and credits. K-12 was relatively constant. Overall, it was a $22 million actually decrease from earlier estimates. Pulling that all together on the bottom of page 10, you'll see again a slightly more detailed look at the budget outlook. We have
got a page 10.
Sorry, on the bottom of page 10, you'll see it's falling revenues, higher spending drive overall budget outlook. And on that page, you'll see that we started with a budget shortfall of $426 million in the current biennium, 2008 and 2009, and the $4.8 billion deficit that we discussed in 2010 and 11.
Chairman,
we started to address. I'm sorry.
Sir Metzen.
Let me ask on thank you, Mr. Chairman, on the top of page 10, that other forecast.
What is the date on yours?
That debt service.
December 4.
How could that go up so darn much?
It's not dated.
Those bonds sold that much higher than we anticipated or what? That seemed like a huge number.
Mr. Chair, Senator, you're right. The difference is because of the interest rate environment. And one thing that happens when we sell bonds is that sometimes we get a premium, an upfront payment, because the interest rates are significantly lower than the expected interest rate. In this instance, we weren't projecting that because of the interest rate environment. And that leads to the number that you see here. Oftentimes, in these forecasts, you'll see actually debt service being a savings item. In the last few forecasts, because there was some upfront payment, because the interest rates were a little bit lower than we were expecting. In this instance, it did not work for us.
Chairman, I'm encouraged by that the recent sale was at $400 million,
yes.
Mr. Stinson, and obviously 4.5 to 3.5 is what about
$4
million on the new issue. But
yes.
this looks
yes.
still looks pretty high to me.
But I guess what it is. But
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, your intuition is right. It's just that this forecast for debt service was based on what Global Insight was saying interest rates were going to be in November, and that was a very bad interest rate situation. And so we would expect there would be less of an increase going forward.
Mr. Chair and Senator,
thank
I should note, Assistant Commissioner Cardell can explain this much more effectively than I can, but the market essentially wants their bonds at 5%. So even if the effective rate is something lower than that, as we mentioned that this last sale went lower, it will essentially provide an upfront payment to make sure that the effective rate is lower. So if that adds significant amounts on the front end of that payment, if it turns out to be 4% versus 4.5%, that interest payment isn't so much. But if you accelerate that over the entire amount, it becomes a much larger number.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, looking again to the summary on the $426 million shortfall in the current biennium, as you know, the $350 million cash flow account, the $155 million budget reserve has been reduced and applied to that. Some initial allotments have been unallotments have been made, and there remains some work to bring that into balance as of the November forecast numbers. Looking out into the future on page 11, the final slide just continues the same picture. We're not anticipating a sharp return to revenue growth in 2012 and 13, and so the challenge that we see in the upcoming biennium persists into 2012 and 13. We're looking at about a $4.6 billion gap, and that's prior to any incorporation of any effects of inflation on the overall forecast. So the challenge that the state has is similar to that which we see in a lot of other states. When I hear from my counterparts in other states, they are also facing very, very challenging economic news, very, very challenging revenue news, and trying to find ways to balance the budgets. Minnesota is not alone in this by any means, but that does not necessarily make it any easier. With that, I think that concludes our comments.
Mr. Chairman.
One other thing, just looking forward to the forecast that we'll be doing at the end of February. Because of the timing of the release of the forecast from Global Insight, it's not going to be physically possible for us to get the forecast done with all the checking that we feel is necessary so it can be released in the month of February. And so we have proposed moving the forecast back, the forecast release date back until March 3rd, Tuesday, March 3rd, so that we can feel more comfortable with the checking that we've done. Now, one of the things that is going to be important in this forecast is the nature of a federal stimulus package and when that federal stimulus package is approved. Global Insight has and will have in their national economic forecast assumptions about the composition of the stimulus package, and that will affect the economic projections that are in there. However, to the extent that there are specific grants to state governments or matching for Medicaid or something like that that's rumored to be part of the federal stimulus package. That will not be counted in the February forecast unless it is in law, because the February forecast is a current law forecast, both with respect to Minnesota law and to U.S. law. And so if the forecast, if the stimulus package is not approved by both houses and signed into law prior to release of the forecast, we won't be counting any money that would come to the state in fiscal 2009 or 10 and 11 as part of the stimulus package in the forecast.
Just relative to that, and I'm not sure if this is directed to Dr. Stinson or Mr. Showalter, President-elect has talked about wanting to sign the stimulus package very soon. I mean, originally he talked about signing it next week, which apparently is not going to happen. For our purposes, let's say hypothetically the stimulus package is not counted in the forecast but is passed, signed into law by, we'll say, mid-March. Would you then provide some kind of change to your budget to reflect that, or would you just wait till next year to see what happens?
Mr. Chair, I can start. I think there's two different pieces to the stimulus package. One is going to be the impact on the overall economy, which there, in all likelihood, Global Insights is going to include some element of.
Yeah, my question is
on the spending side, that if there are increased federal matching for the state Medicaid program, other flexible funds, things like that, I think we're going to have to work out how to recognize that and make sure that that's built into probably everyone's assumption of the budget.
Okay. And let me ask a couple of different questions. Dr. Stinson, you've talked to us in the past about the fact that energy prices, the price of oil per barrel is not a huge driver in terms of the forecast, but is kind of what, small to moderate. And I'm wondering, with this leveling off of oil prices, how that factors in to the November forecast, how it might factor into the February forecast if the expectation is that this is going to continue for some period.
Mr. Chairman, the best analogy for oil price increases or oil price decreases, gasoline price increases, gasoline price decreases, is to think of it as a tax. And when we went from $1.50 a gallon to $4 a gallon in gasoline, that was the equivalent of 200. It's about a penny a gallon is about $1 billion in additional consumer spending that goes on. So when we went from $1.50 to $4, that's $2.50. That's about $250 billion worth of pressure on discretionary consumer income, money that could be spent elsewhere. That helped create a problem for the economy that really offset a lot of the stimulus that came through the federal stimulus package. Now what we've gotten is this decline in prices, which is roughly the same amount. We're talking about roughly the equivalent of a $250 billion tax cut that's metered out every time you go to the gasoline pump, and so it's much less likely to contribute to savings. So this is good. This is a stimulus for the economy. This is one of the few pieces of good news that we've seen in the economy. And it's been built in. It was built into the forecast in November. It will be built into the forecast in all likelihood in February as well. The January forecast has oil prices remaining low clear through mid-2011.
Chairman.
Sir Munson.
How significant, maybe it's not that significant, this legislature, the last one, passed a $1 billion bonding bill, And approximately half of that money is income taxes, people working, and the other half is product, of which is taxed also. We passed a 5 cent per gallon gas tax with some sales tax in the metro area. And the legislature passed, and the people agreed to the so-called legacy bill, which is a lot more money coming in. Now, those three kind of what I think are big income drivers, I'm sure you've considered those, or maybe I'm thinking that those are bigger than they really are, you know, in the big picture in life, but it is a couple billion-dollar deal here for sure, more than that as you go forward. Have you looked at that, and is that significant? Does that make sense? I mean, we did a number of things around here that, you know, the gas tax is certainly going to build some bridges and roads. We're looking for transit stuff, the legacy thing that many people in this room, been, including Senator Anderson and others, have been, you know, and this is a big deal. So I don't know if that's a question or a statement, but it seems to me that's a lot more money going out to work, if you will, or in taxes coming in.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, you're right, it is a big deal. And what's good about it is the fact that it was done 2 years ago and last year, because it takes a while to get this stuff going through the system. And so the fact that you had a big capital budget 2 years ago is going to help us in this weak economy. But even with all of those actions, the economy is still going to be weak. It's just that your foresight 2 years ago has kept it from being even a little weaker than it would be normally.
Chairman, I'm trying to find some positive stuff this morning. So
good work. Sam Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Showalter, your chart on page 11, just to make sure I understand it, says that we have a $4.8 billion deficit in 10 and 11. Then if we resolve that issue, then does that impact your 12-13 figures, or do we have an additional $4.6 billion projected?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it depends how we resolve the 10 and 11 deficit. If we were to resolve it in entirely a one-time nature, that $4.6 billion problem would still be there. If we were to resolve it in a way that dollar for dollar, that same spending or revenue would show up in the same way in the following biennium, that other deficit would disappear.
Mr. Chairman, just one more question. Why is the inflation estimate so different between the two bienniums?
Mr. Chair, Senator, compounding is part of the reason. That you, by the time you get several years out, you've got several years of inflation impact.
Okay.
So it is a matter of looking out multiple years and saying something 3 years from now is going to have a greater amount of inflation just because it's further out into the future.
Dr. Stinson, if I could ask something a little bit different that you haven't touched on. One of the things you've discussed with us over the last year or so is the fact that Minnesota's job growth is, for the first time, behind the national mean. And I believe in your conversations earlier relative to this forecast, I think you see that same trend. So my question is, why are we, and what can we as a legislature do about that, if anything?
Mr. Chairman, there are really two parts to the answer to your question. And the first part of your question is, you know, what's going on? Why historically did we do better than the U.S. average? And now since really 2006, we've done noticeably worse than the U.S. average. The answer to that is we really don't know. There are two possibilities. One possibility is that the recession, for some reason, came to Minnesota earlier than nationally. Part of that could be explained by the behavior in the housing markets. Minnesota's housing markets turned down, construction of housing turned down about a year earlier than the national economy, and Minnesota's lumber and wood products industry has a higher weight than it does nationally, and so we'd be more affected by weakness in the construction sector than the national economy, and so that may explain part of it. Plus, there was the Northwest Airlines bankruptcy. There was there's the ongoing problems at the Ford plant, the shutdown of one shift in there. There's a series of other things that went on, and so it could be that we just entered the recession a little sooner, and that we had a series of shocks that caused a problem for us as well. And if you look back historically, what you see is that Minnesota's strong performance of economic growth came not because we were recession-proof, but because we did better in times of expansion rather than in recession, that we just grew faster than the U.S. when the economy was expanding. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is that there's been a structural change in the U.S. economy, and that structural change has been, at least in the short term, a shift slightly from production of goods for domestic consumption to production of defense material. And if that's true, then that's not a strength of the Minnesota economy either. Now, the second piece of that's implied in your question, I think, and it's something that I talked about a little bit, or I may have talked about a little bit, is that in November, our models for the Minnesota economy showed the Minnesota economy significantly underperforming the U.S. economy going on out into the future in terms of employment and wages and personal income. And what we have seen since the release of the November forecast and the updates in December and January is that Global Insight has moved their forecast of growth in the national economy closer to Minnesota, our forecast of growth in the Minnesota economy, and that while we have ratcheted our forecast for growth in the Minnesota economy back somewhat, it hasn't been proportional. And so the big change that I talked about in terms of the outlook for the U.S. economy is not going to be translated directly into the Minnesota economy, that the change at this point that we have in the Minnesota economy is going to be smaller on a proportional basis. Now, the third part of your question was, what can we do about it in there? And this is something that the state demographer and I have been talking about for a number of years, and you've even probably heard us at least once talk about productivity and how important productivity is for Minnesota's economy and for growth in Minnesota's economy. We have to be very conscious of the fact that in Minnesota, the thing that we have, our advantage, our competitive advantage, is productivity, and we need to be concerned about how do we promote that productivity. And a lot of people think that productivity is just bigger, fancier, shinier new machines that produce things faster, but it's more than that. It's also investment in human capital, because people that are better educated are likely to be more productive. It's investment in infrastructure. It's investment in R&D to produce those new goods and find those new processes so that we can do things faster or produce higher valued products. And those are all issues that have got to be addressed if Minnesota is going to continue to hold its relatively high place in the U.S. in terms of per capita personal income and things like that.
You don't have to respond to this, but that suggests that in putting together a budget, we should pay closer attention to Senator Pappas' division, the higher ed division, or the early childhood programs. It's probably more of a political comment than anything else, but that's what I infer from what you're saying. I have a couple of questions from Mr. Showalter, but other questions from committee members? Senator Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any difference between the definition of a depression and a recession?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, there isn't really a hard definition. Well, the hard definition of a recession is it's whatever the National Bureau of Economic Research says it is. It's not two consecutive quarters of declining GDP or anything like that. There's a group called the National Bureau of Economic Research, and they look at a whole series of indicators, and then after looking at those indicators, say that we're in a recession or not. They don't have a formal definition, and they don't make a call of a depression. But let me contrast what we have seen with the depression of the 1930s. What we saw was a 25% decline in output. Remember, we're talking about a 2.5% decline in output. What we saw was a 25% decline in output that extended over 4 years. What we saw is unemployment rates going from 3.5% to 25%. And again, remember that back in those times, there weren't a lot of dual-income households or anything like that. So you can imagine the difficulties that those would have imposed on there. So, you know, this is a serious recession. It's likely to be the longest recession and the deepest recession since World War II. But it is nowhere near what went on during the Depression. Went from 1929 to 1940. It took until 1940 to get back up to the level of economic output that occurred in 1929. So it extended for an enormous period of time, and it was very, very deep.
Let me ask a couple questions, Mr. Showalter, of yourself. Why was the governor so interested in using up the that last $155 million of the budget reserve? Because both of you suggested, certainly Dr. Stinson has suggested, that the February-March forecast, March 3rd, whatever the date will be, will have a continued – will show an additional deficit relative to this year's biennium – or the current biennium. And the comment was is that it's going to be that much harder to take care of if we have – hypothetically, a $200 million additional deficit, and that's reported March 3rd, we then have only 4 months to work with in terms of cutting that money and nothing to fall back on. It struck me with the forecast from November, December, that it might have been easier to have tried to cut the $426 million. And then when we're in the middle of this session, trying to work on the next biennium's budget, that would be a lot easier than to use the 155, and any cuts that we needed to make would have been not easy, but certainly easier than what will happen. So I never quite understood why there was that rush to use the budget reserve at this stage, given what we expect.
Mr. Chair, I believe I cannot speak for the governor, but I can give you some of the considerations that certainly he was looking at. And that most obvious one is that the unallotment authority is only triggered after the use of the budget reserve. Given the economic context that we're working in, I think it was commonly assumed that we needed to act fairly quickly in order to resolve the 2009 budget gap. Just because the longer we wait, as you mentioned, the fewer options are available. There are ongoing payments to local aids and credits. The last big one went out at the end of December. If we had waited until session started, that would have been done and wouldn't have been an option. There are also ongoing payments to other grant recipients, to other institutions. And so the number of choices that the legislature and the governor have continues to dwindle with literally each passing week, certainly every passing month. So I think there was just some of that urgency to try and start to address that with the recognition that we needed to preserve as many options as possible and get and some of those options on the table right away.
Senator Fredrickson.
Chairman, Mr. Showalter, should we be considering changing that law requiring the use of the budget reserve before on allotment to give the governor more flexibility?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is certainly an option. I think that Minnesota has already a relatively a credit positive for its ability to react to budget deficits through the executive branch fairly quickly. If you look at California and some of the changes and processes that they had to go through in order to address their budget gap, it was difficult, I think, and confusing at best. To do it without going to the budget reserve certainly would give the governor more authority to act quickly and would be a useful tool. I think that's more a legislative executive branch decision.
And if we should allow a certain amount of the budget reserve to stay in place before the unallotment takes place, and something I haven't thought about. I'm sort of thinking out loud here. Committee.
Well, it certainly sounds like that might be a consideration. Obviously, when we put together the budget, if we want to look at some changes in the budget process, we'll have the opportunity to do that. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to suggest that something different could have happened, and that would have been that without unallotting, the governor would have sat down with the legislative leadership and agreed on certain reductions that would have been made very early in the session. And I think that would have been a preferable process. A, we'd still have some budget reserve, and B, we would have more agreement on the direction we were heading in terms of balancing the budget for the next biennium.
Senator Pariso.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to remind people that the legislature was the first one to raid the reserve accounts, if you remember. And so you can't blame the governor for the whole thing because, let's face it, this legislature did it first.
Well, to be fair, Senator Pariso, that's not incorrect, but it was a combination this past year, the governor and the legislature. In terms of utilization,
I understand
of some
that, Mr. Chairman, but you know, if we all want to point fingers, we can just turn them right back on ourselves.
Not so much pointing fingers as just asking what the thought process was, and that actually some of these comments do beg the question then as to when we should expect to see the unallotments for the last whatever it is, 40, 45 million.
Mr. Chair, we're working on it. As you can tell, we have a few things going right now, trying to make sure we have a complete package and. As you know, from past unallotments, it is a detailed exercise because as we're starting to look at smaller accounts, smaller options, and for an unallotment to go forward, we have to be very specific about the dollar amounts, the accounts that those are going out of, and are working with agencies to make sure that we get it right the first time.
Okay. Other questions for Dr. Stinson or Mr. Showalter? Thank you very much for all your time. Next, members, we have former Commissioner Kodrowski, former Commissioner Goodnow. As members might recall, Representative Lencheski and myself had authored legislation establishing a budget trends commission. That was carried in Senator Betzold's bill 2 years ago in the 2007 State Department's bill. And the commission has been working in a very extremely diligent way over these last couple of years. We have the recommendations in front of us, and if you look at the membership of the commission, it was a combination of members selected by the governor, the Senate, and the House, and have done some significant work, so we wanted to spend a few minutes with them. Obviously, we can read this. I've had a chance to go through most of it. I would encourage members to read through this when you get the chance in more detail. But former commissioners, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm Kevin Goodnow, co-chair of the commission.
I'm Jay Kudrowski, the other co-chair.
And, Mr. Chair, could I ask how much time do you have remaining for us?
I don't think we're in session until
11.
11.
Okay. Just wanted
and,
to check.
And, you know, and I was remiss. I apologize, Mr. Goodnow. I was remiss and just noted at the bottom. One of the Senate appointees was former Senate Representative John Brandel. And I had talked to John about serving on the commission. And up until the time he left the Senate, our terms in office were, with the exception of the term of the House, almost coterminous. And obviously he passed away in August. And I have no doubt until he got quite ill this summer, I would expect was a significant part of this.
He was.
So I was remiss in not mentioning that at the outset. So I apologize. But.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we were going to make note of that as well. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the one thing I just want to start off with the commission and with the current budget situation, we have been looked at as the providing the silver bullet solution to the current budget crisis. People have asked us, do you have the solution? And I just want to start off by telling people we don't. That wasn't what we were intending to do. That's not what we were set out to do. And so if that's what you're waiting for, we don't have that here. And I don't expect that the folks around the table expected that. What we were charged with when you set up the commission was looking at the long-term stability of the state budget, looking at the demographic trends that are out there, and looking at the volatility, how we can address that, and potentially how we can manage that into the future. The commission, as the chair mentioned, is made up of 15 members originally, five from the Senate, five from the House, five from appointed by the governor. The commission had quite a diverse group. We had commissioners of finance, four different ones from four different governors' administrations. I had about four economists, I believe, and we reached general agreement on this report, which I thought was amazing. What's the old joke about you put four economists in the room and how many opinions you get? But we came up with a report. The process started almost about a year and a half ago. One of our very first meetings was on a day similar to today, sub-zero weather, trying to get to our meeting location. But over the year and a half, we've had 14 meetings. We first looked at the past reports that were done with regard to these fiscal issues, looked at the best recommendations that came out of those, then took expert testimony from the various agencies and departments, and then we came up with 14 findings and three groups of recommendations. And we'll move right into those findings. And the first one is that Minnesota's and if you want to go to page 5 of the report, we have the finding listed. Minnesota is currently experiencing a major long-range demographic shift.
You can see from the, why don't we just, do you want me to go through the graphics?
Yeah.
You can see at the bottom of page 5 the graph that shows what's happening to, in fact, the over 62 crowd, the baby boomers. You can see it as well on page 6. Essentially what's happening is we're going to be older and, as a result, require more government services going forward, our population.
And that's, I think, that went to take in 14 meetings to determine that. That's the first finding. The other thing that to make note on the graph on page 6 is the increase in the school-age population again. So what we're looking at are people on the front end of life and at the back end of life. They're both kind of, those populations will be increasing as the workforce will be declining. Finding number
two.
Thank you. Minnesota has become more diverse in recent years, and this will continue to increase the economic growth as economic growth depends on attracting new workers to the state.
Minnesota's traditionally had trouble attracting people to meet our workforce needs. We're a net importer of people for the jobs that we create. As we go forward, more and more of those people are going to be diverse, and they also require more assistance in education. They create social concerns, and that's something Minnesota is going to have to deal with again and probably has a negative impact on the need for expenditures going forward.
Finding three is public spending priorities which need to shift as Minnesota's economically dependent population grows larger and relies more heavily on fewer workers.
And the key here is that something called the dependency ratio If you look at the chart at the top of page 8, you'll see that we're really in great shape right about now. Actually, not. We're in better shape now than we're going to be. By 2030, we're actually going to have more people not working in our population than people working. And again, you can think about the implications on that for the state budget. Again, pretty negative. That is, we're going to have to spend more for the elderly and for the young people with fewer working people.
So the burden on the working folks, whereas the dependents tended to be children, now it'll be split between children and their parents and their grandparents. And if there's going to be any pressures in the future, as we felt pressures in the past to come up with support for childcare, I think you might be seeing some pressures in the future about how to deal with your elder care as well. Next finding is, despite continuing to rank high among many key social and economic indicators, Minnesota's economy has underperformed recently relative to the nation. And I know you just visited about that just briefly as well. Moving to finding 5, demographic and economic factors will lead to lower growth of state tax revenues over the next 25 years.
And you can see on page 12, the graph there that suggests where we've had a compound growth rate in our state revenues of 6.8% in 2001, we're now looking at a compound growth rate through 2033 of 3.9%. We should commend the staff that worked with the commission, particularly the Department of Finance, Tom Stinson, Jim Showalter, Britta Rattan, Tom Gillespie, the state demographer, were very helpful in creating helping us understand these issues. And this particular chart and the projection of revenues and expenditures over a 25-year period is the first time it's been done, and the finance department, we think, did a very good job of it. We tweaked it a little bit to make sure that we felt it was accurate. But in essence, what it's saying is our revenue growth going forward is only going to be 3.9% in a normal economy.
The next finding, and I should make note as we are recognizing people at the Department of, what are they, Minnesota Management and Budget Department, Shelley Peterson kept us on the straight and narrow and made sure we got the meetings on time. So we are, thanks go out to her as well. Finding 6. Minnesota has a long-term structural budget problem with long-term expenditure growth likely to outpace revenue growth, and that's on page 13.
If you look at the chart on page 13, you'll see some disconcerting news. In this 25-year projection that was done, we saw that revenue was growing 3.9% from the prior slide, and it's repeated here. And you go all the way to the right, you'll see total spending is going to be going at 5.4%. In other words, Minnesota has a structural imbalance. I believe today, even if there wasn't a recession, we'd have a problem. And clearly, going forward, we will have a problem because the growth rates of expenditures, particularly health care and education, are greater than our capacity to grow revenues under current law.
That leads into the finding number 7, which is healthcare growth will become the most important factor in controlling rising state expenditures in the future.
And we just talked about that.
And finding number 8, state revenue volatility will make long-term budget instability more difficult to manage.
One of the things that Mr. Stinson and his economic staff, in fact, was able to calculate is that we are now today more volatile than we were a decade ago. About 20% more volatile in our revenues than we previously had been. And the reason for that is that we're having the sales tax is not growing as rapidly as is the income tax and corporate income tax. And therefore, they make it more volatile.
And that's basically a reiteration on finding 9, which is Minnesota's general fund tax base has grown more volatile in the past decade.
And you can see that on the top of page 19. This is the history of Minnesota's budget. It's what I've called the Minnesota roller coaster. You can see, depending on how far back you go in your legislative tenure, Mine started in 1983. I watched that rise and dip. We had one in 2001, 2002 with the revenues going up, and then the 2003 with the revenues dropping, and we're clearly experiencing one today.
Next item, and I have to say the next two findings probably resulted in the most commission member time, especially from the economists, making sure that we stated it correctly so everybody would agree to it. Finding number 10 is replacing highly volatile tax-based components with less volatile sources could reduce the volatility of the overall general fund tax system. However, such changes would also affect revenue growth rates and the distribution of the tax burden among taxpayers, which means we can deal with volatility to a certain extent, but you have an impact on the progressivity of your system or the growth rate within your system.
We were really examining the question, if you extended the sales tax to clothing and personal services, there was a belief that you would, in fact, reduce dramatically and or eliminate the volatility in Minnesota's revenue system. Our best conclusion was not likely. In fact, we think it would have a lesser or minor impact on state volatility of revenues. We didn't complete the analysis. We ran out of time, and that's why these words were so carefully chosen, because we don't have the proof. But collectively, I think our judgment was that it wouldn't dramatically reduce the volatility, something that, frankly, as a commission member going in, I thought it would have. And so for me, it was a new news.
And it's related to finding number 11, which is adjusting the mix of the current tax base while remaining revenue growth rate neutral cannot reduce revenue volatility without a dramatic reweighting of tax revenue sources and a radical change in the tax rates to the system.
So if you want to reduce volatility in the state revenues, you have to dramatically change the mix of taxes. Other states don't have as volatile a revenue system as Minnesota, primarily because they depend more heavily on the property tax, which is the most stable of taxes. They also depend more on sales taxes, which are less volatile than income taxes. So our finding really was that if you want to continue the tax system with its progressivity that it has today, with the mix it has, the only way really to deal then with volatility is to go to management tools. You can't do it through just tinkering with the revenue system.
And the factor is it's complicated as well. If you look back on page 20 at the chart on the top of that, it shows individual income tax base, corporate income tax base, sales tax, and revenues. It shows the growth rate, the volatility of each, and its proportion of the general fund. And so if you want to deal with the volatility, you can see the most volatile taxes are the corporate income tax and other revenue. But if you also look at the growth rate, they're also the ones that are projected to grow the highest. So if we have a structural imbalance where right now, projected on a trend line, our revenues are not going to continue to grow at the same pace as our expenditures, and you need to deal with that problem. But at the same time, you're trying to deal with the volatility problem. You've got the solutions are different solutions. And so that's, you know, when you're looking at a tax system, you're looking at a three-legged stool. Or my three-legged stool is the growth rate that we have to deal with, the volatility, and then you look at the progressivity of your system and how you distribute it. And when you affect one, you're going to impact the other two as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Foley.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Goodenow, have you addressed the impact of fees that don't seem to fall in any of those categories?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Foley, no, we did not. That would be... I don't believe fees would be – if they're fees
it's
that went
into
the general
revenue.
Fund, it would be in other revenue. If it right. was fees that went to specific special revenue accounts, I don't believe it was included in that. So to the extent it's in other revenue, it would be part of those numbers.
Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Goodenow, if I read the morning paper correctly,
Star Trib reported that the governor was going to recommend a decrease in the corporate income tax rate. Would you talk a little bit about how that would affect this chart that we were just looking at?
Based on what we talked about, the three-legged stool, so to speak, if you reduce the corporate income tax rate, you would reduce volatility in the system, arguably reduce the volatility. And because it's only 7.4% of total general fund revenues, you would only marginally reduce the volatility in the system because it's such a small portion of the overall revenues. But the potential growth there, you lose that potential growth as well, which could be up to 15% on the trend growth rate. So you lose the potential growth there. Again, the impact would be minimal because, again, it's a small portion of the general fund budget.
The other thing that was done for the first time as part of this commission's work, again, by the state economist and his staff, was not only did we look at the volatility of the individual taxes, but we looked at the interactions they have with each other. So what Kevin just said is correct to the extent that we look at it separately, but we really can't fully answer your question until we would drop it and then put it into the other and see how it interacts with the other taxes. It's that interaction.
One of the things that I found interesting is that you can actually take a volatile tax revenue raiser out of the system and actually make your system more volatile. Because sometimes there are counteracting systems that work together, and even though individually they're volatile, if you bring them together, they stabilize.
In economics, or in investments, it's called portfolio theory, that frankly a 60% bond, 40% stock portfolio is less volatile than a 100% bond portfolio, which is counterintuitive. By adding stocks, you get less volatility.
In the paint business, we call it balloon theory. You push here, it comes out someplace else. Yeah, so. Finding number 12, shifting consumption patterns have reduced Minnesota's sales tax base. Okay. Finding 13, Minnesota's statutory budget reserve ceiling has not grown to an appropriate level to adequately manage the underlying risks in Minnesota's tax system over time.
Interesting story is the commissioner sat around the table, the four of us. Somebody asked, well, where did the budget reserve level come from? And I'm the most senior of the four commissioners. I served the longest ago. And the best of my recollection was that it was Gus Donahoe who thought we could maybe get 5% budget reserve given the $10 billion budget, or about $500 million. And he kind of picked it out of the air. You'll see in a minute that the commission for the first time also had the state economist do work that in fact statistically determined what the size of the budget reserve would have to be to eliminate a certain amount of risk from the forecast. And today's budget reserve, the 500, 650, 850, whichever number you think is the right number, we'll tell you in a minute, is too low.
And just to note, the chart.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh. Senator Thomasoni.
As long as you brought up that historical rendering of how we got there, do you remember how we got the 3% bonding limit?
It's amazing, Mr. Chairman, Senator, that I've been asked that question now twice in the last 2 days. Mr. Showalter indicates that I had something to do with it back in the mid-'80s. Representative Rukavina had a slightly different version of the story that somehow Gus and I in New York came upon that 3% guideline. I frankly can't remember, but that's a whole different discussion, that 3% guideline. But it was it was pulled out of the air, but it's a worthy guideline.
worthy of what?
Fact. A guideline
providing
is worthy,
some
or?
Discipline to the legislature and the governor so that we don't overexpend and overextend our debt for the state.
And Mr. Chair, just to expand a little bit on the budget reserve, if we could go back to that for a minute, the projections on the that you see on the chart on the top of page 24 are based on the scenario of the situation that would happen one in 20 years. So this type of budget reserve would be a reserve that you would need for a situation that would occur once in every 20 years. So basically,
why don't we talk about it right now? The chart on the top of page 24 indicates that if you want to have protection at the 95% confidence level, meaning 19 out of 20 times you would be safe, you would actually need a $2 billion to $2.3 billion reserve over that entire four-year budget period. If you're looking at a two-year budget period, the way we've traditionally looked at it, you would need somewhere around $1.5 billion to provide you protection from the start of the biennium after you had a balanced budget till the end of the biennium. You'd need $1.5 billion, 19 out of 20 times. It so happens this year is the 20th time where this wouldn't have worked. And you can increase your statistical probability of not having a problem, go to 98%, and that number simply gets larger.
The last finding we've made is Minnesota needs a cash flow reserve account of sufficient size so that the state can avoid short-term external borrowing during the biennium.
So if we turn to the recommendations, and I think it's fair to start here by, again, repeating what Kevin said, we don't have the silver bullet for this legislative session. In fact, I don't think there's anything in this report that would help you solve the problem that you face in this biennium. What this report really did was to look at the future demographics and to give you some advice on what to do given those future demographics, but more importantly to say, how can you avoid getting into the current budget situation you're in a sense, trying to have Minnesota be deficit-free going into the future, so that it ends up that this is the third commission that I've served on to deal with this issue. And I don't want there to be a fourth one that I have to serve on again. You'll see a number of our recommendations are from prior reports. What it requires is for you today to plant the seeds. They're going to be relatively painless because you don't have any money. To plant those seeds today such that by the time we get to the next recession, the plants will have grown to be able to weather that next recession. So let's look at these recommendations. The first one is to create a permanent long-range planning function in state government. There was one. The Ventura administration eliminated the department. We have no comment as to whether all of the functions in the department were worthy, but we do believe having a permanent long-range planning function that deals with both finance and demographics is critical for the state and needs to be resurrected. And it was the Carlson Report in 1992 that said that. And Kevin, jump in here if you have anything you want to add.
You're doing great.
We believe that we ought to release a demographic forecast at the beginning of each biennium. We give a lot of attention to the finances of the state, but frankly, some of the demographic information we found and looked at is going to tell you more about the future of the state and what we need to do than simply looking at the financial information. So we want to elevate that demographic look at the future than we have previously. The third one is, and this one was the single most controversial recommendation of the commission, that financial forecasts should be based on current law and inflation or deflation of both revenues and expenditures to provide an accurate planning perspective. It goes on to say, however, that budget should not automatically fund inflation allowances. Base spending should be scrutinized. In other words, we think the majority of the commission believed that it was worthy to, in fact, include inflation in all of the projections, and we did in the 25-year projections we did, and we think you should in the budget projections that are presented. But in no way do we think having inflation in those projections means in any way that it should automatically be funded, that is a budgetary decision, and the governor and the legislature have every right to take it out as they start their deliberations on appropriations.
And Mr. Chairman, I can just make a comment that out of all the findings and the recommendation, this is the only one that was not a consensus. And after, even though it was the most, quote, controversial, we did not spend the most time on this issue. I think Art Rolnick probably summed it up the best. He said, I think inflation should be included, but, you know, in the big scheme of things and what we're dealing with here, this is really kind of a small point. And so that was where the commission kind of, everybody agreed with that, and we just went our own ways. But not enough said on that one.
Go down to the middle of page 27. The next recommendation was to minimize the tax exemptions, deductions, and credits unless necessary for federal conformity. The reason for that recommendation is that through the acts of the governor and the legislature over the past decade, we in fact have made, through these exemptions and credits, the revenue system more volatile than it had previously been. The next one on the top of page 28, to help the governor and legislature manage long-term obligations, the state should begin by spending no more in the current biennial budget than can be supported by ongoing revenues. This is, in fact, what you didn't do the last legislative session. You did not balance ongoing revenues with ongoing expenditures, and as a result, you left $1 billion-plus problem for this biennium, meaning it wasn't balanced. Obviously, that gets you into trouble. The problem would be less this year if it had been done that way last year. Next one, any additional one-time revenue should be used strictly for building reserves, paying off shifts, capital projects, and other one-time purposes. Mr. Chairman, members of this committee, I was before this committee 2 years ago when you had some one-time-only money, and I strongly urge you to spend it on one-time-only items. While that was partly done, it partly wasn't done and built into the base, and now we're going to be looking, I suspect, at cutting back those expenditures that were put in on a permanent basis. Expenditure forecast should include information about rates of growth by expenditure area. The department or Minnesota Management and Budget felt fairly strongly that if we looked at the expenditure growth by category, it would give us more insight into what we must do as we go forward. The governor and the legislature should create a structurally balanced budget for the current and following biennium. This has been reported in the news as us recommending, in a sense, a four-year budget. I think that's a little bit inaccurate. What we are saying, though, is that as you complete your work on the biennial budget, you should be also doing a projection of the biennial budget on the following biennium. And if there's a deficit in that following biennium, you really haven't put yourself into a strong financial position. You're starting out in a hole for the future, is what it amounts to. And we think it would be far better discipline if you were able to balance both the current biennium as well as the following biennial budget. And you actually saw that in Jim Showalter's graph today, and the question was asked about the amount of the deficit in the out biennium, the 2012 and 13 biennium. And frankly, if you solve on a permanent basis the deficit for this biennium, it will, in fact, it appears, take care of the deficit for the following biennium. When making budgetary decisions to achieve a balance of expenditure and revenues, the governor legislature should consider the impact of shifting expenditure burden to the private sector or local units of government. There's a great tendency for you as legislators, for the governor, even though often you've served in local government prior to coming here, to in fact want to push the problem to local government to solve, in addition to you solving parts of it here. You just need to be aware of the impacts that you're having in local government as you do that. The next recommendation is Kevin's favorite. He'll speak to it. Create a long-term public-private group with the responsibility to annually recommend policy changes for controlling the total cost of public health care and medical assistance services.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one of the things that we identified as the findings is the inflation, the growth factor within the health care budget in the human service or in the state budget. We did not have any great answers for how to deal with that and control that problem. And we felt we needed to come up with a recommendation to recognize that we need to do something about it, and this is the best thing we could come up with. Now, having said that, I'm the first one to acknowledge and tell you that this is not a perfect solution to getting a handle on that growth rate and how to control that into the future. The growth rate is because of a number of decisions that were made in the past and priorities of the state with regard to a number of different things, covering people with health care eligibility and covering them with health care so they have access to health care, but also includes a real strong commitment by the state to make sure that people, our most vulnerable people, are part of our communities and not part of institutions and take care of institutions. And what we're seeing is are the impacts of those decisions over the years. And we need to get a handle on where that growth is at, especially if you want to bring the revenues in line with the expenditures. I know this has been tried many times, many years. Just last year, there was a commission put together to try to identify ways to control the cost of health care. There are no easy solutions here. It's very difficult. They're based on priorities we have set as a people, as a state, and as citizens. But we need to start talking about those priorities and how we can manage those costs in the future. So, again, recognizing this is not a silver bullet, but just wanting to recognize that we know there's a problem there. We just don't have the magic answer for anybody. And I'll let Senator Berglund come up with that magic answer. So.
On page 29, we also realized that it's critical that the educational attainment gap that's occurring today, i.e. our high school graduation rates have been dropping, needs to be addressed because, again, if you think about it, more people not working than working. The people that are working need to be as productive as possible. I think you heard Tom Stinson talk about productivity as being one of the most important things as we go forward. The next whole item was under is about budget stability. The first recommendation is probably the biggest change, in addition to maybe the size of the budget reserve, and that's that if the forecast revenues exceed the trend growth line, trend line revenue growth rates should be the basis for spending decisions. In essence, what we're saying, and again, there were four former commissioners of finance, that we didn't serve the state as well as we might have, because in good times, we frankly told you in the economic forecast that things were going to continue going up, even though we knew that there would be a recession some point in the future. So what in fact occurred was that we overspent, believing the trend line would continue up, knowing full well that at some point it was going to turn down, and that created the budget deficits. Best example is 1999. One of the commissioners of finance at that time said there were boatloads of money. The projection showed lots of growth going forward. We thought we were in a new time. High tech was the future. And we reduced taxes permanently, and we increased expenditures permanently in 1999. We came back in the 2000 legislative session, if my dates are correct, and did the school reform, all of which changed dramatically the requirements of the state and the revenue base of the state. By 2003, we found that a mild recession would put us into deficit given that. And now in 2009, we're finding that a severe recession really puts us into trouble. And I would argue that we really did not have a structurally balanced budget after the 1999 legislative session. We had set the situation such that in good times we'd be okay, but in bad times we'd have trouble, and that if we had a normal year, we in fact wouldn't have had enough revenues to finance the expenditures that we had. In this recommendation, what we're saying is that when we are in good times, we should not use Global Insight's forecast for continued growth, even though they have a scenario that says there is a recession in the future, but we take the growth scenario. We, in fact, should use the trend line of growth, which would be lower, which would take some of the growth off the table and not allow the legislature and the governor to spend it, because it, in fact, oftentimes is never realized and it puts you into deficit.
So what you're looking at is you have a trend line that is based on spending or factors over a period of time, revenue growth over a period of time. That is the trend line that you would look at as your baseline, so to speak, that if you look at a snapshot of the two-year period or the four-year period, you may see revenue growth that exceeds that trend line or it may be below that trend line. When that revenue growth exceeds the trend line, the recommendation is that you would recognize, you would only be able to spend up to the trend line. You'd recognize the trend line as the growth, that anything above that trend line you would identify as one-time, potential one-time spending, but you wouldn't actually be able to spend it until after it's been collected. So it'd be after the, so rather than projecting that you're having it and then at the end of the 2 years and then spend it before you have it, it's you project that you'll have it and then you aren't able to access that money until after the 2 year period after it's actually collected. That will help with the ups and downs. The 1999 situation, and I was one of the spenders, we had a snapshot of 4 years where we saw the trend lines were going like this. What we didn't see was 6 and 7 when the trend lines started to go back down again. So if you base your spending patterns or tax cuts on the fact you think the trend line is like this, and you don't recognize the fact it's going to go down, that's where you run into the problem in the structural issues that Jay was mentioning.
If you look at the next bullet, it coincides with this and says permanent tax reductions or expenditure increase should only be undertaken under certain circumstances, and those certain circumstances would be that the budget reserve is built back up to not what we now believe to be at least $1.6 billion up to $2.1 billion, that in fact you bought back all of your shifts, that in fact have an adequate cash flow reserve, that you meet all these requirements, and only then, if your revenues are exceeding your expenditures, could you look at making a permanent permanent decrease in one of your taxes or a permanent increase in one of your expenditures. Tough medicine. The next one is that the size of the budget reserve should be determined regularly by the Department of Finance using the model they developed. It's a statistical model based on the actual volatility history of the state that would tell you what the budget reserve should be. The current calculation, again, is on the next bullet on page 30. For the four-year period, it's $2.1 billion. The commission is recommending that, in fact, given that we don't think, and we had no recommendation, but we doubt that you're going to change dramatically the tax system. Therefore, the only way to manage volatility in this Minnesota situation is through a budget reserve, and the size needs to be in that $2.1 billion range for a four-year period.
And part of the reason we did decide to make the recommendation, move it from a two-year budget reserve to a four-year. One of the frustrations I've experienced over the years, I guess I still continue to experience this frustration, is that we have the budget reserve to help with economic downturns, yet at the same time you're using the budget reserve to balance the budget and to stave off some very tough cuts to programs. You're asked to replenish it at the very exact same time. So is it really a budget reserve, or is it some other type of reserve that we have to identify there? So the idea of a four-year reserve is that it will allow you more tools to manage over a period of time without having to go as deep in the cuts. It should not be used as an excuse not to make corrections to the system that need to be made, but it will allow you time to have some of those corrections implemented over a period of time rather than having to do dramatic things very quickly in the situation.
The next recommendation is if the budget reserve is depleted in the current biennium, it should be replenished within two biennia. And this is really relevant to you today. The commission is not suggesting that you set aside $2 billion today for the budget reserve. Again, four of us had been in the position that you're in our 10 years. We had legislators as well on the commission. What we are saying, though, is to set the goal now, balance the budget this year, and say if any excess revenue comes in the future, that it be dedicated to that budget reserve, and that we expect over a two biennia period you can build up that budget reserve to the appropriate level. So that's the key for this session, is to put into law that provision that says excess revenues or excess balances go into the budget reserve. The third bullet on page 30, a cash flow account should be maintained. We had a lot of discussion about this. It would be unfortunate if the state went into short-term borrowing. I was part of the department in 1983 where we did have to do short-term borrowing for the first time in the state's history and the last time. It's something the state doesn't want to do. It can affect our credit rating. It's costly. And frankly, if the state's credit rating is impacted, then generally credit ratings across the state are impacted. So it's something we really don't want to do. The last bullet says that the department will provide you an estimate on what the size of the cash flow reserve has to be in conjunction with the governor's recommendation. As the legislature complete its work, there may be a different cash flow amount that's needed by the because of what you did with appropriations and taxes, but we need to have that reserve for cash flow purposes to keep the state out of short-term borrowing.
And the key recommendations with regard to the cash flow is that, number one, that it be based on the budget needs and the needs of the state rather than on just a flat number that we just pulled out of the air. And number two, that one thing to keep in mind is right now that we're able to keep the cash flow account at the level it's at and use it and avoid external short-term borrowing because the Department of Finance is able to borrow from do interfund borrowing. So they will borrow money from other funds within state government. So as you're looking at solutions in setting your budgets for each biennium, to the extent you impact those balances, those funds that state government has right now that they've been able to access for short-term borrowing, you will have an impact on the amount of cash flow account that you need as well. So if they've borrowed from funds in the past and those funds are no longer there, the amount of your cash reserve account needs to go up. And so that's a calculation that MMB should make in each budget cycle rather than just having a flat dollar amount be seen as the answer for cash flow.
So, Mr. Chairman, in conclusion, what the Commission has put forth to you in our best efforts is a financial game plan to avoid very difficult budget volatility and deficits the next time the recession occurs. You've got to deal with this recession and balancing this budget, but you also can plant the seeds such that a future legislature, some of you who will be part of that legislature, won't have to deal with as severe a problem as you're dealing with this year.
Okay, well, thank you and appreciate all the work. Let me just ask a couple of questions. And Mr. Kudrowski, you raised this toward the outset, and that is that you were a little bit surprised that what had always been considered the panacea to expand the sales tax base, lower the rate, really doesn't make any difference or makes, what, very minimal difference?
We don't think it has the kind of impact that we generally thought it would have had to dramatically reduce the volatility. We haven't statistically demonstrated yet exactly how much, but I think the majority opinion was that it would not be significant.
So what I'm taking from the report is the way to a significant part of structural stability is new spending, i.e. increase the budget reserve and the cash flow account.
Well, we should, with regard to the expansion of the sales tax base, and I think it needs to be clear that it's not necessarily the solution for the volatility issue.
Right.
It may have other solutions. There may be other reasons to do it. So that's just so we can lay that out. But as far as what we were able to identify is that there is no short of just restructuring the whole system. And basically, if you want to reduce volatility, you have to rely more on stable taxes, which the most stable is property taxes. And so, but when you do that, then you lose the progressivity of it. So if you're not going to substantially change this current system, you're not going to be able to substantially remove the volatility out of it. If you don't do that, then we had to come up and we identified tools that you could use to manage the volatility. So if you can't solve the problem, because we've agreed that there's a reason why we have the problem and we're not willing to do other things to the system in order to solve that problem, then we have to figure out what tools do you need to manage that volatility.
The three key recommendations are not only to create a far larger budget reserve, but secondly, in good times, not to over-forecast revenues, as we traditionally have done. And third, it's to very carefully look at the next biennium beyond the biennium you're dealing with to see the impact of your decisions on that future biennium. And we're arguing that, in fact, a test for the legislature and the governor should be that out biennium is balanced as well as the current biennium.
Of course, the problem for all of us in the legislature is, quite often we and this is what your report cautions against. We always go for the path of least resistance, and the path of least resistance is let's finish this year, and next year I think it's going to be better. I hope it's going to be better. And certainly what we did this past year is illustrative of that, although I think the expectation was on the part of all of us that when we left $940 million at the bottom line, I'm not sure anybody in the legislature expected that. I hope nobody in the legislature expected that that was going to go away. That would have been a naivete of significance on the part of anybody who might have thought otherwise. But some of what you're suggesting is we have to change the way we think about the budget, even separate from what comprises the budget. And so I'm struck by your comment that or the recommendation that we budget based on trend lines to a greater extent than we do.
Only when we're in good times. Obviously, you can't when we're in bad times because you got to balance the budget and you got to take the real forecast. Okay, but in good times, all it does is set you up for failure because it gives you it's like the Trojan horse. It appears to be something worthy and good, but it causes you trouble because you spend it and it ends up you didn't have it.
Well, probably the best illustration that was the 2001 session.
Yes.
And certainly when Governor Ventura pulled his punch on what he recommended by way of the revenue end of it, but we adopted the spending end of it, and that certainly exacerbated what happened to us in 2003.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just, some could read this as an indictment of the legislature or questioning decisions that have been made, and that was never the intent of the commission. You asked us to look at the volatility in the demographics, and that's what we came back with. The decisions that were made back in 99, 2001, and other times were made among the people that were elected at that time, and they were, well, including myself, making the best choices available based on the information they had at the time. And what we want to do is just share this information, saying as we go forward, we can't count on the same economic bubbles that we've had in the past, and we have the demographic issues we're going to have to deal with, and we need to figure out and maybe look at things a little bit differently as we move forward.
Well, and that's the other thing that comes through pretty strongly is on the demographic end of it, that given some of the changes expected, anticipated in the state's demographics, that we're not going to be looking at the latter part of the 90s.
Right.
That would be very much of a surprise.
What has traditionally bailed Minnesota out of its deficits won't be there in the future, in our best judgment, because of the demographics.
At least we can't count.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, is this study online someplace? We're probably all going to be having town meetings.
The Department of Finance website has a special section about the Budget Trend Study Commission. All the reports that we looked at, all the presentations we looked at, there's a set of references relating to other studies that have been done, and that is and the report's now online as well.
Thanks.
Senator Berglund.
Easiest question to answer all day.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if the commission looked at this, but this is sort of one of my frustrations, and that is that the state government is much better at forecasting how much we can spend on something than they are at forecasting how much we can save by doing something. And so I'll just give you an example. Over the last 4 years in Minnesota, we have 10,000 more people living with diabetes and having it under control than we did before that time. But the Department of Human Services shows that the things we're doing to make that happen cost money. Doesn't save money. And if it did save money, it would only save the Medicare system money, not the healthcare systems that the state pays for. I don't believe that's true. I believe that a number of those 10,000 people, if their diabetes wasn't under control, would end up in our long-term care system, and the state would end up being responsible for them. I don't know if you talked about that sort of thing at all, but to me it's very frustrating because why should we work at trying to save money if we never get credit for it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, it was discussed. And not specifically that example, but the frustration with the fact that we don't have good modeling around proposed changes, and I use the example of the Medicaid budget. If you had an idea that we expect, we want to make this change, what is the impact of that change? We don't have a good model to determine what that impact may be. And the other thing is we don't have a good model to track the changes to see if what we thought would happen actually did happen. Because it just gets wrapped into the big Medicaid system. It's part of the forecast, and nobody pays attention to it after that. So I think I may have gone on longer than what the rest of the commission may have liked me to go on about that issue. I'm sure you understand the feeling.
I do.
it was discussed that what we really do need is better modeling for setting budgets and tracking the budgets as we go forward. There's not an off-the-shelf product out there that does that, though. And that's what we need to work towards, and that would be ideal as we move forward in trying to manage the budget in the future.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, let me answer your questions just slightly differently, because I think Kevin gave you the commission's answer. But I want to broaden it out a little bit, because I've been asked the question, well, so what if we have deficits that, you know, then we just solve them and move on, and if we have surpluses, that's great. And so what's wrong with this system we have? Well, I think what's wrong with the system we have is that we're always seemingly in crisis, a crisis to either spend money or a crisis to save money. And when you're in crisis across government, you don't have time to do the good, clear thinking you need to make better public policy. And I think the reason we don't have the models that we ought to have in looking at some of our expenditures is because all the people today are involved in trying to figure out how they're going to survive with the budget cuts that are coming. And that's what really harms our state, is having to deal with all these deficits and the roller coaster of our finances, is that it takes time away from really doing a better job of improving the effectiveness and efficiency of our services.
Mr. Chairman, to that point.
Senator Thomas, sorry.
But isn't this a national problem? I mean, isn't every state experiencing what we're experiencing?
Every state, Mr. Chairman, with the exception of Alaska and a couple of others because of certain circumstances. But Minnesota has traditionally had it the worst because we've got a more volatile system. It's also a more progressive system. We have parts of it that we like, but it comes with parts we don't like. And so our swings are larger than the swings that other states face.
And I have to say this, and I've said it before, as far as our forecasting and our budget management, we are pretty hard on ourselves about how off we are and how bad we make our, you know, how far off our forecasts are. But the reality is, as a state, Minnesota is pretty well managed on that end. We do a good job, a very good job as compared to other states. But as our expectations for ourselves are a lot higher, I think, than other states may have for themselves, how they manage their budgets. Because a lot of states don't even look at the second biennium. And we've had that as a practice for a number of years. And so I think when it comes from at least looking at future impacts, we are further along than a lot of states are in looking at that. I think the commission recommendations would say we need to go the next step further.
Let me take the example of sales tax on food. Many states have a sales tax on food. I'm not advocating it, but many states have a sales tax on food. When the economy turns down, that tax doesn't drop as rapidly as the Minnesota sales tax, which is essentially on durable goods. Okay? And they aren't going to have the budget swings that Minnesota has as a result. Now, there are reasons why you don't want to put a sales tax on food, but you can see the point.
Okay.
Senator Dave.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that was mentioned, and I was wondering if you've looked at, or when you were discussing this, you mentioned the most stable tax is the property tax, and I totally agree with you. And I've always thought that legislators, what we do is we get together and we say, okay, the local property tax doesn't really fund our schools. I mean, maybe 10% or so. We also, in a lot of the state, probably 40% of the cities are funded from the taxpayers up to the state, and then we send it back. And I've always thought that if there's an area where actually there's more accountability, and I think we have to go back and put more of the tax burden back onto the property tax, which is stable. And I know legislators, you know, but when you look at our system, we're even out of balance on how we can mandate things and do different things to local government because we're sending them their chunk of money. And I was wondering if anybody, is that something everybody kind of shies away from, or did you discuss that?
Ms. Chair, Senator Day, I'll let you fight the fight on if we should increase the burden on the property taxpayers versus the other ones. Just to remind you of one of the things we said is property tax base may be the most stable tax source out there, one of the most stable of the large sources. It also doesn't have the growth factor in it that some of the other ones do. So that itself will help with the volatility issue, but it won't necessarily solve the structural imbalance you have on expenditures versus revenues. And if you put that into place and you reduce, for example, the corporate income tax, that will actually have you going the other direction on trying to solve the structural imbalance issue, although it will help you on the volatility issue.
Further questions for either Mr. Kudowski or Mr. Goodnow? Well, I very much appreciate the work you've done. And I would like to suggest to members, I'm going to have a chance, and Mr. Kudowski, maybe we could, if you can stick around for a couple minutes, maybe we can at least talk for a couple minutes as we had discussed. I'm going to try to incorporate some of this into bill form during the session. Obviously, we're not going to appropriate money for a $2 billion budget reserve. And I think that's your point, that with kind of the feast or famine situation we often find ourselves in, that you know, we just kind of stagger out of the session without doing some of the long-term stuff. And that's why I certainly appreciate what you and the other commission members have done. And I know that you gave up significant amounts of your time to work on this with little or no compensation. I think no compensation.
No compensation.
And little glory. But I'm hoping this does not become a commission report that shows up on you know, bookshelves over the years, but that we can at least this year begin some of the work toward implementation of some of these recommendations. So I really appreciate what you and the other commission members have done. And I think in establishing the commission, you've more than succeeded in the expectations that at least Representative Lincheski and I had, and I think other members of the legislature. So thanks for being with us. Very much appreciate it. And then we have, I don't think it should take more than a few minutes, we have Senate File 4, Senator Metzen.
Do you have to move that report, or how does that work? I don't know.
Division.
Thank you, Chairman.
Senator Thomas only moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Metzen.
Thank you. Senate file number 4 is an unemployment insurance state extension. Deed has, you have in your file, a pretty good snapshot, I think, from Department of Employment and Economic Development that kind of spells it out pretty well. This bill has been heard on the Jobs, Economic, Business Committee and lately in, again, in Senator Tomasoni's division. And I might add there was no opposition that came forward. 10% of Minnesotans will exhaust their regular state benefits and will not qualify for the federal extension. This bill clears that up, and they will be eligible. There's about 3,000 workers right now that we have to get at, or some of us think we have to get to right away. If we delay this bill, where these people could fall between the cracks and not get these benefits. So that's why, Mr. Chairman and members, the urgency of this UI bill today. There probably will be another UI bill later, but this one is so important that we're not making it a Christmas tree or doing anything else to it. And it pretty much piggybacks on the federal extension guidelines. The federal government currently has in place extension that provides for up to 33 weeks of benefits. We've done this before, I believe, in 2002. I believe it was a Senator Anderson bill, so this is not a new thing. There will be a price tag of about $4 or $5 million, but or maybe a little more. But in the big picture, in this these kind of benefits, it's not quite frankly that significant because it's a $400 or $500 million issue, and that'll be assessed later on. And the benefits would amount to about, I believe, about $215 per person that would qualify. And most other states in this category do allow these benefits to these people. So that kind of and a little part of it, the bill updates the system somewhat and will get us to more current wage information. So we believe, and the department believes, that when that part of the bill is enacted, that it should streamline the system somewhat and maybe even save some money. So we've got Deed is here. Maybe you can, if you want more details of the weeks and the periods, they could give that to committee. But again, nobody has stepped forward, and it might be going good enough, or we might not need you, but you're no, I'm just kidding. I don't know that. But is there anything, Mr. Chairman, that Mr. Nelson could?
Yeah, Mr. Nelson, if you just want to comment on what the department is doing, not doing, and what you see in terms of the rest of the session relative to this.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program. The department will have an unemployment insurance bill. It will be part of a department overall package bill. The department will have one bill coming forward, and a couple of the articles will deal with unemployment insurance, relatively minor. But we feel this is a very important particular bill. It was done in 2002, as Senator Metzen has indicated. And it's kind of unusual that Minnesota has this problem and most states don't. Minnesota has this problem because we pay fairly high weekly benefits in relation to what's called your base period earnings than other states. If we, in fact, paid lower weekly benefits, more people would qualify for the federal extension. It's because Minnesota provides a little bit better benefits that they actually lose overall because of the loss of the federal extension. It's kind of a weird anomaly, if you would.
Is there any expectation that I don't think I've seen any discussion when the stimulus package has been discussed of unemployment compensation, but do you know if there's any discussion at this stage at a federal level of doing anything else, or will we see more revisions of this as the session proceeds?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you won't see any particular in relation to this. There are some bills floating in Congress which may require some legislative action later, but it won't require a change in this particular piece. But those may or may not pass. We don't know what will occur in Congress.
But as I understand it, you're expecting to see a continued deficit, and certainly if unemployment worsens over the next several months, that would exacerbate the situation.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Other than I'm not quite sure how to respond to that question, we do expect unemployment rates to increase. We do expect the number of the amount of payouts to increase dramatically. We do expect the unemployment insurance trust fund to go into deficit status, and we are monitoring that situation. And you know, we are again going to come forward with some proposals later, but they don't need to come forward exactly at this point. What we want to do is make sure we don't overreact or underreact, and we get a little better handle. We know what the projections are, but we don't know whether reality mirrors some of those projections. In fact, Minnesota's unemployment rate actually came in a little better than had been projected in the month of November. How that December we'll come back. We will know next week.
Okay. Further questions? Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I know that the unemployment fund is supposed to run into deficit, and that is projected to be at the end of this year. And how much faster will we go into deficit by extending this benefit to
we let me take I think it's 1 or 2 days so it's not a big, you know, in the whole bigger picture it's 2 days, so it's not a lot.
Mr. Chair. Senator Metzen, when you were putting this together, it appears that the people will continue to receive the same level of benefits that they've received in the past 4 quarters, right? Or is that how it is? It's extending their unemployment benefits another quarter, and they'll continue to receive the same level, even though it will be out of the state's UI fund instead of the federal extension. Was there any thought given to any reduction, a percent of reduction? I'm somewhat concerned that that people will think we'll keep doing this and that we won't cut them at all, and therefore their incentive to continue to look for work, although I know it's a difficult time to find employment, but their incentive is not there unless we start maybe subtracting a little bit so that they know this is not going to go on indefinitely.
I personally, I understand what you're saying, but I did not look at the reductions in other areas in this legislation. I'm just trying to help a very select group, but that's something I'm sure we could at a different time. But this is so critical right now that
Mr. Nelson,
I feel we have to pass it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, the average benefit be paid out is $215 a week. That means the individuals averaged a little over $400 a week when they were working. Decreasing that amount, these people have an incentive to get a job. They're getting $215 a week. I don't feel that's a particularly high payment. Decreasing that, these people spend the money. I'm not sure they're saving any of that money out of the $215. I'm not sure decreasing
not
it's
if they buy
cause
groceries
more of an incentive to get the
work. I think, Senator Roebling, if I might, you might be thinking of not so much this narrow one, but the overall picture is what I get out of your
question.
Right.
And, Mr. Chair, I mean, we are saying that the state average payment is much higher than the federal.
That's what you're getting.
So, you know, obviously other people in other states are getting less, and I don't know how they're doing. Maybe our cost of living is a little bit higher here, and so we can account for some of that. But I'm just thinking if we have to fall into line a little more, this is where we could start as the extensions continue.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to make the same point that Mr. Nelson made, that the folks that we're talking about are already experiencing a major pay cut and are, for the most part, probably in a very difficult straits trying to just hold on to their house or their apartment, their car, and buy groceries, car payments, whatever other bills they have, they're not going to be able to keep up with, for the most part, under the payment structure that we have. So they have a huge incentive to be looking for work, and they're also required to be looking for work, and that's part of what our law makes them do, is to at least document that they're trying to look for work.
Mr. Chair, just very briefly, I was watching the news the other night, like most of us do, I guess. This lady was working at a food shelf. And her neighbor lady, let's call her Phyllis, came in, and the lady says, Phyllis, are you here to help at the food shelf? She says, no, I'm here for food. And this lady working there had no idea, and this is what's happening out there. So it's just a story that stuck with me, and it was kind of sad. You know. But anyway, we should do this, and we're going to try to get it done today on the floor.
Further questions? If not, Senator Metzen moves that Senate File 4 be recommended to pass. And Senator Metzen, this is going to the floor, correct?
That's correct, yeah. Thank you.
Further discussion on Senator Metzen's motion. If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion
thank
carries.
You. Thank you very much.
Do you want to adjourn?
Committee's adjourned.
All right.
Thank you.